Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hemmerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
The Elusive Truth of Lily Temple by Joanna Davidson Politano. Peter Driscoll, an underground investigator to the wealthy, has been tasked with uncovering the legendary Briarwood Teardrop, an exquisite sapphire which is currently in the possession of beautiful silent film actress Lily Temple. In order to stay closer to her, he employs Lily on one of his cases, which leads to a useful partnership. Lily is both charming and quick-witted, but behind her costumes and make-believe world is a woman with a murky past that includes the Briarwood Teardrop, which she will neither part with nor explain its presence. As she continues to work with Peter, her own story weaves in and out of their encounters, and hints about her background begin to surface. As Peter draws closer to the truth about Lily's past, danger draws closer to both of them. It is soon obvious that he needs her help as much as she needs his, especially when his life is dependent on Lily's ability to spin a believable tale.
On this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense, I'm chatting with Joanna Davidson Politano, the award-winning author of Lady Jane Disappears and a whole bunch of other books you can read about in the notes. She loves tales that capture the colorful, exquisite details in ordinary lives, and I love that. I think that's a very fun way to think about writing. So welcome to my show, Joanna.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking me on here.
So let's just go a little bit more with that tales that capture the colorful, exquisite details in the ordinary lives. How does that tie into writing romantic suspense?
Well, there's so much in ordinary everyday life that can create this like micro tension. So there's huge tension like car chases and things like that. But what I really, really enjoy is micro tension. So a conversation where two people don't quite agree or something like that. And it's just common everyday things so that, you know, readers can identify with what they're going through. But you still get a lot of tension in there.
Oh, I love that. That can be fun. I like to write about ordinary people myself, who just kind of happen to, by no fault of their own, really, stumble onto, you know, suspenseful things. But yeah, I love micro tension stuff. It can be such fun to write. So does that go along with how you connect with your characters? Do you kind of think about those kind of moments, the ordinary moments, and that how you build your characters, or how do you connect with them?
Oh, sure. A lot of it is they're sort of a conglomeration of different people I know. So just people in my average, ordinary life. I take little pieces, little quirks, little things like that, and put them all together. And then I watch them do ordinary things. But a lot of times I try to make them just a little larger than life, just a little bit more quirky than the people they're based on. Just take it a little step further so they're really interesting. But I want it to feel like they're friends of mine, so that they will have conversations with me and tell me what they're going to do next.
I love that. I'm often talking to my characters, or they're talking to me. So I'm glad I'm not the only writer out there. Okay, I don't feel so weird anymore. But how do you find time to write? I mean, are you a full-time writer? What's your writing schedule like?
I am a very part-time writer. I put a lot of work into my books. But I guess the biggest secret is to be fully present in whatever I'm doing. So I'm a stay-at-home homeschooling mom. I have three kids, and they're little. So they really need a lot of my attention, and I definitely don't begrudge them that. So when they're awake, I am a mom. I don't talk on the phone about books. I don't write. I don't research. I don't do any marketing or anything related to books. I am just their mom. But then for like a couple hours in the afternoon, my baby goes to sleep. My kids do their independent work and their chores. And that's time that they're building their independence. And that's when I sit and write. And then when they go to bed in the evenings, I carve out some time for marketing and a little bit more brainstorming and writing and things like that. So, and then when I'm writing, I'm fully present with my book. I don't allow interruptions. I have scheduled time, and I write until my baby wakes up.
Ah, that's a great schedule, and I guess you'll be adjusting that as your baby somehow doesn't take naps anymore one day.
He's 2.5, so that's coming, and I don't know what I'm
Yes, gonna... yeah. Yeah, I think I cried when I have 4 kids, and they're all teenagers are in college now, and I think I used to write a lot in the afternoons when they were resting. They all had rest or naps, and I just remember when the last one, I was like, what, you're not sleeping anymore? Anyway.
Oh, it's such a good day.
It was, I know. It's just those little things, and you're like, there goes my whole schedule. No, you just kind of rearrange it. You know, they still have, like you said, quiet time or rest time or whatever you want to call it. But, yeah, always fun when those things change. So what's your go-to when you need to pick me up to kind of keep you writing?
Honestly, this is such a strange go-to, but I get bored. And the reason that helps is because I'm sort of turning off my conscious brain and accessing the subconscious brain. So I'll go for a long, rambling walk where I don't have a goal. I don't have a purpose. Or I'll take a shower, or I'll drive in the car. And the key is to not be listening to a podcast or talking on the phone or anything like that. Just let your mind wander. And quite often it will fix a lot of story problems. The creativity just kind of blossoms. And it's so much fun. So that's probably the most helpful thing that I finally figured out.
Yes, yeah. I often, especially when my kids were younger and couldn't do as many chores, you know, washing the dishes or sometimes unloading the dishwasher, or, you know, it was always good time to kind of think about
right.
plot points and other things like that. So what do you find is the most rewarding thing about writing romantic suspense?
I think the most rewarding thing is when all the pieces come together by accident. Like, things connect up. You kind of have, like, an end in mind, but then there's so many things along the way that connect up to the end, or your end changes, which mine probably does every book at least once. But when things start to pull together and, like, it's just wonderful because the clues are buried because you didn't know they were there. You didn't intentionally put them in. So you can often surprise readers by surprising yourself.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not the only one who sometimes is like, oh, well, that's why I put that in chapter 4.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm further absolutely. Along in the book, I'm like, oh, okay. All right, well, yeah, now that I did that, I can actually, this will work. I don't know how my brain works that way, but... apparently yours does similar, so yay, that's always fun when that happens, and I hope my readers are, you know, happy about that as well. And so I like that you picked this question, Joanna, because it's one that just kind of cracks me up myself, that how you research ways to kill someone for your book. So tell me how you've done that.
Well, I'm sure my Google search would get me arrested.
Yeah.
But I have a librarian who knows me by sight. Like, it's a small town, so she just knows who I am. And she's always pulling out, oh, I found this book on poisons. Oh, I found this book on weaponry. And, like, she's always pulling stuff out for me. And I pore over those books. And a lot of times I get story ideas from researching how to kill somebody. And honestly, one of the funniest things that happened in researching how to kill somebody was I called actually the guy I was dating at the time, who's now my husband. He was at this giant work conference for engineers. They're not the imaginative, writerly type.
No.
And my husband is he's Italian, and he's got a very loud voice. So I called him, and I'm trying to work out the logistics of how somebody would die, and he's arguing with me about how it wouldn't work very loudly. And he suddenly realized that half the convention was looking at him as he argued with his wife about how to kill somebody. it was pretty wonderful.
That is funny. That is funny. They must have been thinking, yeah, I don't want to sit next to that guy. So what do readers ask? What are some of the questions they ask when they meet you?
Almost always they ask, where do you get your story ideas? And what do you do when you get stuck? Those are the two biggest ones. And I guess the other one is, what are the secrets to, like, surprising your readers at the end? What's, you know, the twist? How do you do a twist?
Yeah.
So
and how do you answer them?
Well, my ideas, I mean, every writer can tell you, they just come from everywhere, but a lot of mine come from researching history, like the odd little corners of history that nobody sees. I'll find a person that did something really unique, and I'm just like, oh, that's really cool, and I'll kind of spin off from there. Another thing I do is when I'm watching movies and I try to guess how a suspense movie is going to end, and I'm wrong, I'm like, oh, but that's a viable twist. That's a viable ending. And so I take a teeny little nugget from that movie, not like the whole plot, of course, but like, oh, that person could have been hiding, or that person could have been a twin. And I write a whole story about, where there was a twin as the twist or something. So that's where I get my story ideas. As far as writing good twists, I think I kind of touched on this before, but the biggest thing is to surprise yourself. So I tell people all the time that I always know how my books are going to end when I start writing, and I'm always wrong. And I'm good with that because when I'm wrong, that means I haven't just planted clues along the way and like kind of artfully tried to cover them up with all the tactics that writers normally use. They're buried because I didn't know they were a clue. I try to focus the book on the wrong question. So, like, this woman is trying to figure out how her mother died, and she's piling up all these clues and things like that, that people are dropping. And then it turns out it wasn't her mother that died, but it was somebody else, which means all the clues mean something different. But nobody was looking for how this other person died, so the clues that we left for that person kind of got missed. So that's pretty fun. I also like to my books to my friends when they're 80% written, ask them how it ends, and then take all their ideas out and make sure I write something different.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. And so I think the other question you said readers ask is, what do you do when you get stuck?
Right. That one we talked about before, where
Oh, you
I
go
pretty much
walk
just,
in, yeah.
I make myself bored so that my subconscious takes over. I also delete the part that's bothering me. So, like, if I get to a certain point and I'm just stuck, I delete a few chapters until I like the sto like until I get back to the point where I was liking the story, and then I turn the corner and go back. So that always helps me too. So I can't get too hung up on what's written, and I have to be okay with cutting words.
Yes. Sometimes I know as I'm writing it, I'm going to cut it, but I need to write it to get the thing that I know I don't want, but I can't get to the other thing because it's like buried under this other layer in my brain or something. I don't know. Our minds work in very unusual and unique ways. Well, and we are out of time, but I am so delighted that you were able to share with us about the writing, your writing, and a little bit more about the process you go through. So thanks again for being on my show, Joanna.
Well, thanks for so much for having me.
And state listeners, stay tuned and you'll get an excerpt from The Elusive Truth of Lily Temple.
Now an excerpt from The Elusive Truth of Lily Temple by Joanna Davidson Politano. Whitestone Manor, Hove Seaside, 1903. I hadn't decided if I'd tell the whole truth or not when the men arrived. Peter would have, because he's Peter. I, however, never let facts hinder the power of a good story. Like water, innocuous and common, a good tale rushes forward, carving its own path through rock and hill and sod, sculpting the earth into a bold new landscape before anyone knows what is happening. Where Peter used silence, patience, and unending goodness, the best weapon in my quiver was the pointed truth, driven home by the arrow of a well-told tale. Truth has many facets anyway, such as this place, for example. I sat back against the French provincial sofa, sipping orange blossom tea and appreciating the details of the well-appointed withdrawing room. It did not brag outright, but held a subtle air of opulence, lace dripping like icicles off every surface, crystal accents hanging here and there from lamps and curtains. Solid mahogany furniture from the earlier years of Queen Victoria presented a shabby yet comfortable air. A steady Mozart tempo crackled over the gramophone, and a thick blanket spread over my lap kept me quite warm, along with the fire popping in the hearth. Yet what an unmitigated disaster the place was from the outside. The half-abandoned old country estate rambled more than Aunt Agatha on a winter's eve, with crooked turrets hanging off jettisoned walls, crumbling facades, and a pile of bricks that had once served as steps. Whole sections of roof were missing in the closed-off wings. Ah, the deception of it all. That was life, though. The stories you tell yourself and the stories you present to onlookers. Rarely did the two match. We're all of us a combination of romance novels, humorous tales, and tragedies, depending on what angle we show the world. Me, I preferred adventure stories. Tolerated a romance now and again. Another sip, citrus flooding the senses, and the front door clattered open. The men were back. I clutched the cup handle. It was time. My scattered brain thought of Peter again, his steady, watchful look that penetrated the fluff and pomp of my stories, my silly misdirections, seeing the truth immediately. I shivered in my damp clothing. In a way, it was to his benefit that he was locked up just now, and he could not interrupt my story or correct it. It was all for him, anyway. For wretched, foolish, overly principled, utterly irreplaceable Peter Driscoll. Not that he completely deserved it, mind you, this rescue attempt. The man might be guilty of a great many things, petty annoyances and rude infractions and the like. Killing me, however, was not one of them. The shucking of rain gear sounded, and the growl and tromp of a man in the corridor. I sipped. Waited. The parlor door banged open, and there stood the muddiest uniform I'd ever seen, worn by a giant of a man who looked mad as hops.
What? Who are you?
I dropped another sugar into my tea and gave it a good stir. I'm Lily Temple, Mr. Mutton, and I'm here to help you. He stood like a wide-eyed fool, dripping mud and rain upon the worn rug.
But you're in my house!
The most logical place to find you, sir. In another twist still, the grand old conflicted mansion was, in fact, a prison, a temporary holding place for criminals of the Brighton and Hove areas while they awaited transportation to their own personal miscarriage of justice at London's Old Bailey, my Peter being one of them. I'm not one for trekking over field and farrow to chase a man down, especially in a storm. I straightened on the horsehair sofa, shoving aside the lap blanket and tucking my booted feet beneath the sofa, anchoring myself. I've come to speak with you about a prisoner if you could spare a moment. Maybe two or three, since the weather will keep you inside anyway. Come and sit, I've made a fire. Still, he stood and dripped.
How in blazes did you get in here?
The door. I paused for a sip, and it warmed my insides. I'd have to break a window otherwise, and I didn't cotton to the idea of shredding a new shirtwaist on the shards. His gaze swiveled to the window as if to assure himself that rain did indeed patter on the thick glass panes, then back to me.
The door was locked!
Indeed, it was. Oh, how uncouth of me. There now, let me fetch you some, too. Have you another cup? I sprang up and walked to the cabinet where I'd found mine. Do you take sugar? He took four steps in my direction, wood squeaking under his heavy boots, eyes narrowing in a rocky old face as his gravelly voice rumbled in my ear.
Get out, you fool woman! Now!
My hands closed around a cup, and I paused, breathing deeply of stale air. After you've heard me out. He wouldn't agree to it, though. I could tell by the look on his face. he'd live to regret it. Lily Temple did have a few more aces up her sleeve. The man yanked the empty cup from my hand and hurled it to the floor, stalking away.
Who the dickens do you think you are?
I told you, I'm Lily Temple, and it's in your best interest to hear me out. His eyes went wide at the name that was only now registering.
You're
stubborn. I strode right up to him, the clicks of my boots resounding through the emptiness. 100%. And there's something you must know about Peter Driscoll. He isn't guilty, and it's terribly vile you holding him here this way. He stared, pale and wide-eyed, then snapped back to composure.
I'll not be convinced of nothing, you hear? They pay me too well to keep them locked up, and I won't ruin that to release them. Not even one. They're a dangerous lot, these prisoners.
I laughed. I couldn't help myself. Perhaps it was everything at stake, my taut nerves, or the idea of Peter Driscoll being called dangerous. They pay you in what? Lodging? I glanced around the dusty old manor house turned prison. He scowled over his shoulder.
Driscoll killed a woman. Did you know that?
Did he, though? He looked down, then back up at me, quite obviously confused, scrambling to understand, or deciding whether or not to believe the name I'd given him.
Exactly 16 different witnesses say he did, and he stole a priceless gem from her, the Briarwood Teardrop, no less. No magistrate in London will let him off, not unless he dies before he reaches the gallows, God guard his poor soul. Mark my words, the man will swing for it.
I dropped my teacup, which shattered on the floor. Boots pounded by the front door.
What was that?
Then yells echoing through the empty halls.
Here! It was in here!
Oh, good. An audience. Mutton thrust me toward the door.
Out, out, out! I'll not be caught with some little chit on my hands. All kinds of trouble to pay. Go on, out with you.
But my story, you haven't heard it yet. My voice echoed in the narrow hall. It's a rather good one.
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.